From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as the Mackinac Policy Conference gets underway, we will talk with the chair of Michigan's Republican Party.
And this is a responsible approach to minimum wage.
And we'll hear what's on the mind from the chair of Michigan's Democrats.
I think, and it's what the voters are watching for. Which side, which candidate, which party is going to create a state that they can stay and succeed in?
Plus, we look at the rise in low-wage jobs in Michigan.
If you are doing the right thing in our state, you're playing by the rules, you're trying to do what everybody wants you to do, you still can't make ends meet.
And we mark the closing of the first video store in the country, a farewell to Thomas Video of Royal Oak. Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. But first, the news. Many in state government tout the fact that more jobs have been created in the past 10 years, but these are not necessarily high-paying jobs with benefits. Sometimes there's not enough of a paycheck to raise a family of four above the poverty line. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, what does it mean if the economy is creating mainly low-wage, unskilled jobs? Then later in the hour, we'll listen to the winners from Michigan Radio's Great Michigan Read 1-Minute Story Writing Contest. The theme for the contest was Hidden Branches of Your Family Tree, unexpected stories that change the way you think of yourself or your family. But first, the 2014 Mackinac Policy Conference began today at the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. Political and business leaders are gathering to discuss the big issues and challenges that face Michigan and to hear from guest speakers. And with statewide elections just about 5 months away, there's plenty to talk about. Joining us now from Mackinac is Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics co-host, Zoe Clark. Hello.
Hi, Cindy.
Listen, how much can happen, Zoe, during this policy conference? It really has true substance and meaning to people in Michigan that takes it beyond schmoozing and enjoying the view from the porch of the Grand Hotel?
Yes. I mean, that is the ultimate question. It's a really fair question, right? I mean, you've got about 1,500 people here. This is a group, as you said, of lawmakers, of entrepreneurs, CEOs, business folks, and they all come together on an island. And yes, there is schmoozing. But there is also a sense that bigger things are being done, maybe not in front of the media, maybe not in front of some of the panel discussions. But this is a point where people are mingling and talking about big issues. Just actually to my side is Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville. Looks like he just got up here. People are talking to him about road funding and issues like that. So, you know, it is a time to bend ears of people. And I do think it's fair to say that, you know, plans are hatched and made here, whether we always know about them or not.
What are some of the highlights of the week ahead?
Well, earlier today, we saw this reception with Terry Lind Land, the Republican running for the open U.S. Senate seat that Carl Levin is retiring from, and also heard from Gary Peters. We already heard from Governor Snyder. As I mentioned, there are lots of people right now milling about talking to each other. We'll also hear from Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan. We're waiting to hear from Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr. So obviously, you know, this is the Detroit Regional Chamber Conference. So there is a lot of talk, of course, as there has been in the conferences for years and years about Detroit and its financial situation and hopefully its comeback.
So you can't underestimate the importance of FaceTime over maybe a drink at the Grand Hotel.
Exactly. And unfortunately, maybe if you want to say unfortunately, that is how business gets done here. I'm not necessarily advocating for it. But, you know, there is schmoozing. There are people kicking back. That's absolutely for sure. But things are also happening, whether we can see them or not. And that'll be very interesting to watch and see what comes out of this. And there's also the expectation of, you know, surprise announcements here and there that always seem to happen on the island.
Zoe Clark, co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Thanks, Zoe.
Thanks, Cindy.
Now, let's keep the upcoming election in mind and get the views from the Michigan leaders of both parties. Joining us now from Mackinac Island, we welcome the chair of the Michigan Republican Party, Bobby Shostak. Good to have you with us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Well, as of course you know, there's a new minimum wage law in Michigan and a lot of controversy about how and why this increase happened. Governor Snyder signed it into law. In your mind, is this increase to $9.25 an hour an appropriate one?
Well, what's most important, it was a very balanced and reasonable approach, an approach that took study by the legislature, that, you know, we really applaud them for doing so, having a an approach like this rather than a ballot initiative was appropriate, and we're glad that the legislature took it up and applied a good and fair analysis to it and put forth this wage increase that they did.
But the way it was passed, in order to render that ballot initiative for 10-10 an hour moot, there's that poll that just came out yesterday showing even people who say the Republicans didn't like that tactic of ramming the legislation through specifically to kill off the ballot proposal, yet some 300,000 people signed and supported that. Can you understand voter anger at the way this happened?
Well, I think what we're hearing from is the group that was sponsoring the ballot initiative. I think what people in Michigan would want is a fair and a balanced and an appropriate look at the issue as part of a total economic plan for Michigan. And rather than just taking, one issue by itself and pushing through an increase that was stimulated by some talk in Washington, rather than the legislature taking it up in a thoughtful and responsible manner. And this is a responsible approach to minimum wage. And therefore, I think we all have to, respond in a positive way. Michigan Republicans are looking out for the citizens of Michigan, seeing an improved economy, seeing a growing economy. Yet at the same time, in a manner that will allow job growth to continue and we maintain our recovery. And that's why this was an appropriate response.
Let's turn to election 2014 politics. Earlier today, Republican candidate for Senate Terry Lind Land took the stage in an event at the Mackinac Policy Conference. Democratic candidate Gary Peters was also there. And it really wasn't billed as a debate per se. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, should there be open debates in the Senate race?
Well, I think there ultimately will be. I think at this stage it's a little bit early, but I suspect that they will debate. And this was a forum to get to know the candidates. The chamber conference, is really not a political conference or political electeds attend people such as myself and other officials. But it's really more for a policy conference. And so this was a good way to have the candidates come out and express their positions on, various important issues to Michigan citizens, energy, immigration, and the like. And so it was a good forum for that.
Bobby, I remember talking to you about this time last year, and you said then you thought that a Republican primary for the Senate seat would be good for the party to get different Republicans out there vying for the seat and debating and getting the Republican message out to voters. And certainly now it looks like the nomination is Terry Lind Land's. So is that a detriment to the party? Did you lose that chance you spoke about last year?
No, I still stand by that I think when you have the opportunity for a primary, you have an opportunity for candidates to express themselves and to work on their message and to give voters an opportunity to hear their thought process develop. It wasn't to be this time, and that's okay. It's the way it shook out. Terry Lind showed that she was interested early. She kind of hung around in the process watching how some of the members from Washington might react to possibly the opportunity to run. They chose not to. And she stayed attentive and put her name in officially and got the signatures and is now our candidate. We're very excited about her and the way she handled it and how well she's doing. It's all towards a good opportunity for us to take the seat back.
Bobby Shostak, chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, speaking to us from the Mackinac Policy Conference. Thanks so much, Bobby.
Thank you.
Now to the chair of the Democratic Party in Michigan. Lon Johnson, welcome back to Stateside. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on today.
I want to ask you a similar question to the one I asked Bobby Shostak, and that is about the minimum wage. I'm sure it's fair to assume you are certainly for an increase in the minimum wage, but which one? Would you like to see it raised to 10 an hour as the ballot initiative drive wanted, or are you satisfied with what the legislature did and the governor signed at 9 1/4 an hour?
Well, 9 1/4 an hour was a compromise that was worked on by both the Democrats and the Republicans. The governor signed it. It's a win for the people of Michigan. Let's move forward and start talking about how we keep going and creating more jobs.
And one of the reasons for that ballot drive to increase the minimum wage is that it was a popular issue, and a lot of Democrats believe it would get voters who may otherwise stay home to the polls. If this doesn't make it to the ballot, are you concerned about turnout come November?
We have many, many issues here to turn the Democratic vote out in the state of Michigan. When this governor took over, we were at the fifth highest unemployment rate. Well, today we're still at the fifth highest unemployment rate in the nation. What he's doing just isn't enough. When you look out in terms of voter turnout, there's not one constituency in the state of Michigan that hasn't paid a price for this governor and this party's inability or unwillingness to compromise to create change. With seniors, they're now paying a pension tax. Middle-class families are seeing higher taxes across the board. Teachers and students have seen $1 billion taken from their classrooms. Labor has seen their collective bargaining rights stripped away from them. Women have seen their reproductive rights under assault continuously at the state capitol. We've got everything we need to go out there and turn our vote out.
And you say you've really, you know, you want to focus on getting out the vote among Democrats. There does seem to be kind of a reluctance, if you will, about midterm elections. What does that tell you about the party and what you need to do between now and November?
Well, you know, Michigan, Michigan's an overwhelmingly Democratic state. We won the last six Senate races we fought together for. We won the last six presidential races we fought together for. But we're just not winning on the off-year election. And the reason for that is depressed voter turnout. What we've identified at the party is 1 million, nearly 1 million, 995,000 to be exact, ID'd Democrats that typically don't vote in the off-year election. Our challenge and our job and our charge at the party is to identify them, get messages, and get our candidates in front of them and make sure that they turn out. When we do that, we will win.
What will you watch for this week at the conference, Lon? You've got a conference that's very business-friendly. It's probably fair to say a group that leans Republican. What do you want Democrats to accomplish this week at Mackinac?
Well, first off, the biggest thing I'm going to watch for is the horse droppings on the street.
There's that.
You know, what we're watching for here is you know, which I think, and it's what the voters are watching for, which side, which candidate, which party is going to create a state that they can stay and succeed in. You know, that's really the challenge for us here in Michigan. How do I stay here and not have to move to Chicago or San Francisco or New York or L.A. to get to succeed? And more to the point, how are my children going to be able to stay here and succeed? Democrats, the vision that we'll be putting out and our candidates are putting out is, you know, we believe the way to do that is to invest in and protect our greatest assets, our people, our land, and our Great Lakes.
Lon Johnson, chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, speaking to us from the porch of the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. Lon, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, failure. There are only about 1 million inspirational quotes and platitudes about what we can learn from failing. But instead of hearing all those, we will turn our attention to our partners over at Grand Rapids-based Failure Lab. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Family shapes your DNA and identity. But what if what you know and understand about your family wasn't true? Like learning for the first time that you're adopted, or you have a sibling you didn't know about from your mother's first marriage. These are the types of secrets that inspired the Michigan Humanities Council's pick for the Great Michigan Read program this year. The book is called Annie's Ghosts, A Journey into a Family Secret by Steve Luxenberg. The novel was inspired by a secret in the author's own family.
My mother had a secret, which she kept her entire life. She didn't tell her children that she had a sister who was institutionalized for 31 years in a Michigan hospital called Eloise. And when we found out about this, which was inadvertent and not something we were digging for, at least for me, I needed to reimagine my mother and my entire family story, because when Mom was growing up, she told elaborate stories about how she was an only child, and those turned out not to be true.
And Luxenberg said those secrets have big impacts.
For me, this is a story that's a universal one. It's a story of identity, the identity that my mom reinvented for herself. Certainly a story familiar to many other people as she became a grown-up and decided that she was going to hide the existence of her sister. And she destroyed a lot of her background and didn't talk about that part of it that would refute her only child stories that she had told us. For my aunt, I think it was losing her identity. She went into a hospital where she became anonymous. And for me, as the inheritor of all of this, I had to look at my own identity and who I thought I was. And so I think of the book as a story about identity, and that's certainly a universal story that I think a lot of people can identify with.
And we wanted to hear your stories about the hidden branches of your family tree. We asked you to write a 1-minute story on the topic and we chose three winners. Here they are.
My sister found the briefcase when she went snooping in our mother's closet. She presented her findings to me. Should we read the letters? No, I replied, holding on to my belief that two people with 22 years between them could fall in love as international pen pals and build a life around that story. We won't read them then, she said, sighing. 4 years later, my 18-year-old self sat at the kitchen table after my father's wake, contemplating, of all things, drinking my first cup of black coffee. My mother sat across from me in silence. I was a mail-order bride, you know, she said to me before wandering out of the kitchen. I tore through the briefcase.
Pen Pals was the title of that story. It was written by Jennifer Young and read by Adrian Pissoni. This next story was written by Mary Seelhorst and is read by Kathleen Beardmore. It's called The Revelation.
Portsmouth, Ohio, 1951. Walking with his new wife, my father watched an older man shuffling toward them. As they drew closer, he saw a face partially paralyzed, tragic eyes, trembling hands. Poor bastard, he thought. I wonder what happened to him. Suddenly, his wife drew up stiffly. Uncle Noah, it's been so long since I've seen you. They spoke quietly, pleasantries mostly. Then Uncle Noah limped on. Uncle Jack, Uncle Hobart, but Uncle Noah. Before he could ask, the woman who became my mother leaned toward him, eyes straight ahead, voice low. They never did get the bullet out of his brain. As if it were normal. As if he knew what had happened, and why.
At my grandmother's funeral, I learned that when she was 20, she divorced her first husband. My father, a successful business executive, once told me he wasn't close with his own father. As I scanned the room, I saw sitting in the very back an older man, his gray hair wild and a single eye patch covering an old wound. His tattooed hand shook as he downed quickly a shot of bourbon from a flask. His features were not unlike that of my own father's, and it was at that moment that I realized there was an entire world my father had been desperate to keep me from. It was like looking into a mirror, though the mirror had been cracked.
That last story was written by Michael Arnold and read by Christopher N. Blaker. The story is entitled The Cracked Mirror. And now let's hear another story, this time from Failure Lab Grand Rapids.
My failure. My failure.
My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore. I can't do
this. Here's Katie Corrales.
I grew up in a place where people didn't just live, they achieved. Most of the adults I knew didn't work somewhere, they were something. I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm an engineer. Our collective infinitive verb form was to be. So the question, what do you do, actually meant, who are you? None of this concerned me very much because I always knew what I was going to do when I grew up. I was going to make a difference. See, I'd also grown up with a strong sense of everything I'd been given, and no question that I would someday give back. So when I graduated from the University of Michigan at 22, I decided to join Teach for America, an organization that recruits recent college graduates to go and teach for 2 years in underserved or low-income areas. The application and interview process was rigorous, and when I was chosen, I felt like I'd finally realized my life's calling. I'd always wanted to be a teacher, and finally that dream was becoming a reality. So I packed everything I owned into my little Grand Am, and I moved over 2,000 miles to Phoenix, Arizona, to begin my career teaching high school English. And it felt good, if not a little strange, when people asked, what do you do? To say, I'm a teacher. I knew it was going to be the most challenging thing I'd ever set out to do. I just did not yet have any idea what that meant. I began working over 80 hours a week to try to be prepared for the 150 teenagers in whose futures I'd just invested stock. 150 students, each at their own level, with their own needs and their own hopes. A student who came to school early every morning to get extra help with her work, and a student who needed the directions repeated slowly because her English wasn't very good. A student who wrote essays about wanting to be the first in his family to go to college, to not go to prison. And a student who sat in the first row, and one day when I was particularly frustrated with a common misspelled word, and I told my class, "Awesome has an E at the end," and I wrote it in big letters on the board, he blurted out, "Since when?" And I so professionally responded, "Since always." I wanted to give them everything. My students would leave at the end of the day, and I would sit at my desk and I would cry. And I felt that no matter how much I cried, the desert earth would swallow my tears and ask for more. Just like no matter how much of myself I gave to my students, they were always going to need more. It was never going to be enough. The panic attack started almost immediately. And I don't think that panic attack is really the right description, because it's my understanding that those are isolated episodes. And for me, once the anxiety set in, it was so pervasive and so unrelenting that I seemed to be living in a constant state of panic. My heart would race all day, and I'd fall into bed at night to sleep for the 4 hours I had time for, and I'd wake up with a start, always in the middle of a nightmare. You'll want to know what happened. You'll have questions, for which my only answer will be yes. Yes, I was too young. Yes, I was too inexperienced. Yes, I was too far from home. Yes, I was too naive, too hopeful, too tired. And I didn't have enough time, and I didn't have enough sleep, and I didn't have enough tears or enough energy or enough fortitude. When I tell this story, I want to give my students guns or knives, some tangible threat that could induce such panic and fear. A problem easier to imagine than the quiet violence of teenagers who can't write in complete sentences or read their textbooks, who come to school hungry for attention, for knowledge, for success. There's a kind of fear that comes from being new at a job, and a kind of fear that comes from being away from everything familiar. And then there's a kind of fear that comes from looking into the eyes of 150 kids and seeing that we live in a world that has not given them the chance they deserve. One day during my prep hour, I picked up the phone in my classroom, and I called an emergency mental health hotline. And I told them, "I'm having severe panic attacks, and I need someone to help me." It was the first time in my life that I truly learned what it meant to ask for help. While I'd always been a worrier, I'd never been an overly anxious person, and I found that the scariest thing about panic is how intensely irrational it is. When the therapist asked me about suicidal thoughts, it seemed so bizarrely off base, because while I had no real intentions of harming myself, I felt certain there was simply no way I'd continue living until the next day. I started seeing a therapist twice a week, and with her support, I was able to make the decision to quit my job. It felt like I'd been fighting forever, but in the end, I would spend less than 10 weeks as a teacher. What do you do? Sometimes, I sit very still in the very center of my bed. I pull my knees to my chest, and I slowly smooth the sheets away from me with the palms of my hands, and I try to keep the world from falling apart.
That was Katie Corrales telling her story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. Good run, a 40-year run. But now the curtain is closing on Thomas Video in Royal Oak in Oakland County.
They billed themselves as the first video store in the United States, and now they're one of the last. Through the decades, Thomas Video has built a reputation as the place to track down obscure, foreign, and art videos, as well as the newest hits. Jim Olensky is the co-owner of Thomas Video. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you thought you were going to be a filmmaker. Did you ever expect to be presiding over one of the nation's premier video stores?
Well, actually, I didn't think I was going to be a filmmaker. That was a college thing, and very quickly shifted more into the musician mode for that. But actually, with Thomas Video, was actually started in 1974 as Thomas Film Classics, selling film. And I was a customer for the first year. I came in the second year in 1975, and then in 1977, I acquired half the store.
Mm-hmm.
And then by 1982, Dennis Thomas was gone completely, and myself and Gary Reichel, my bandmate in Cinecide, and I own the store.
And you really have a reputation of having the coolest stuff. How did that evolve as opposed to just go find the latest hits or the typical classics?
Well, I think that's because, our taste, always lean towards the more obscure and certainly the independent, both in music and film. And, we just went with our tastes. And once it really got rolling and other stores came around, it became pretty obvious it would be good to have a niche. But we do, and we always have carried all the mainstream stuff, too. Some people don't realize that. We always had the new releases and things like that. We just brought in more new things every week than the other stores.
How is it that you know Thomas Video was the first of its kind in the country?
Well, what's considered the start of home video is in 1977. In late 1977, the first 50 home video titles were brought out by Magnetic Video on Beta. And, a few months later, in early 78, they came out on VHS. And the gentleman from Magnetic Video, Andre Bly, his plan was to just sell things mail order. Mm. So we were able to take him out to dinner. And after that and a few drinks, we got the movies. So everybody else who got those movies, they had to order them retail by mail order. And it took him at least 4 to 6 weeks, if not longer, to get them. Now, Andre Bly actually did give us a letter stating we were his first customer. So that makes us the first video store, at least in the country. Could be the world, but we're not sure about, like, Japan and things
sure.
like that.
Sure. Now, let me ask you this. Should you have pulled the plug before this?
Heck yeah. But the problem was we loved the store too much. We also had this thing. We always thought we were providing a community service by having the esoteric movies in addition to the mainstream movies. And that was a part of it too. So it's just – but at this point, we dropped so much money into it the last half a dozen years that we should have closed up 6 years ago when we moved.
What did you win most, do you think? Was it Netflix? Was it Amazon? What do you think it was?
I'd say Netflix and probably the downloads, both legal and illegal.
So it's not as difficult as it once was to seek out the esoteric and the obscure.
Right, right. It definitely. So, in the early days of video, it was, we provided, I think, along with, I'm sure, some other stores across the country, a new venue for independent films and cult films and all that sort of thing. So.
Well, now that you are going to be closing after 40 years and you are doing talk about a liquidation sale, what kind of stock do you have and do you still have stuff for people to buy?
We have plenty of stuff left. People don't realize how many items we had at the store, but we have tons of mainstream, culty, foreign, classic DVDs, also VHS tapes, also Laserdiscs. Also, we've got a load of vintage TVs and radios that are all up on the block. Pretty much everything. A lot of actual Thomas Video memorabilia, too, like, Ghoul banners and things like that, too. So even our signs.
Wow. In your view, how do you think we will be consuming movies going forward?
They'll be beamed directly into our head. I really don't know. I think this is what's going on. It's going to end up being the streaming. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to ever be, all the stuff you want to see. But I think that's what it's going to be, is pretty much all streaming shortly.
Are you feeling nostalgia, relief, disappointment, freedom, happy? What are you feeling?
I think when the sale's done, I'll feel very sad. Right now, there's just so much to do that I don't know. I don't know how I feel at this point. Maybe I'm ignoring it.
And then what for you and Gary after the store closes?
Well, I think we're going to, because of the decision to put so much money back in, mm-hmm. we're both going to be looking for jobs. But really, I want to get through this, clear my head a little bit, and then just, decide what to do and go after it again. So.
Jim Olensky, co-owner of Thomas Video in Royal Oak, the oldest in the country, shutting its doors after 40 years. You can find them in Royal Oak. They're on Rochester Road, just south of 14 Mile. And as he said, if you want to go find a ghoul banner or an old radio or an old sign or an obscure movie, that's the place to do it while they're still there. Jim, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Cindy.
Still to come, projections for Michigan show the fastest-growing jobs will be the ones that pay so little that full-time workers might still need state assistance to get by. How the recession turned middle-class jobs into low-wage jobs. That comes up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 4 years into the recovery from the Great Recession, what kinds of jobs are most available? A recent report from the National Employment Law Project finds the poor economy has replaced good jobs with bad ones. And a recent analysis done for Bridge Magazine in Michigan looked at the fastest growing jobs in this state and found that pay will be so low, many workers in full-time jobs would qualify for food stamps. Let's talk more about this now as we welcome Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard. Good to have you back on Stateside, Charlie.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
And the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, Gilda Jacobs, who also was a state legislator for many, many years. It's very good to have you with us on Stateside, Gilda.
So pleased to be with you. Thank you.
Charlie, how has this recovery differed from the period that followed the 2001 recession?
Well, I think the big difference is that the 2001 recession was fairly mild as recessions go, and the recession of 07, 08, and 09 was by far the worst of our lifetime, the worst since the Great Depression of the 1930s, and so it just did a whole lot more damage. And we are still struggling to get back to the employment levels that we had, but since it did more damage, that sort of magnified one of the effects that almost always happens during a recession, which is that the more highly skilled, more highly educated workers are the least likely to lose their jobs, and then those at the bottom of the skilled chain are the most likely to lose their jobs. And so the unemployment rate skyrocketed for those with only a high school diploma or those who are high school dropouts. And if you're unemployed for a very long period of time, it makes it that much more difficult to get back into the labor market.
And isn't it true that, as we hear reports, we'll just talk about the U.S. economy, that the U.S. economy is rebounding. We hear that from Wall Street. We hear that from the White House saying the unemployment is going down. But isn't some of that a mirage? Because don't the statistics stop counting those who have just given up in despair and stop looking?
Oh, in terms of the unemployment rate is now back down to about where it was before the Great Recession. But the unemployment rate, you only get counted as unemployed if you are in the labor market, meaning you're actively seeking work. And it is true that there are a lot of people who are, we call, discouraged workers. Then there's another category of folks, which is actually larger than the discouraged workers. Those are the people who want to work full-time. They're able to find employment, but it's only part-time employment. So if you include all of those folks, the level of sort of disemployment is much bigger than the simple unemployment rate would make it appear.
Gilda Jacobs is president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. What are your thoughts about the recovery path that Michigan is now on 4 years in?
Well, thanks. That's a great question. The fact is that the recovery has been good for some people in Michigan, but there are still so many people who are still reeling from the effects of that downturn where they are not feeling the effects of an economic recovery. So we have got so many low-income moms, wage earners, that are breadwinners in their families trying to support their kids. that are not able to do so. When you take a look at, like, 2 out of 5 low-income working households are headed by women, and almost a quarter of those people are mothers to young kids. So, yep, there has been a recovery in Michigan, but it's really been benefiting most of the people who are at the very top of the income scale. And the disparities in our state continue to grow.
Charlie, what's driving this growth of these low-paying jobs? And give us an idea of the kind of jobs that are expected to grow at such a fast rate.
Well, go ahead,
projections
Charlie.
Of where the jobs are going to go, you should always take them with a grain of salt, because we don't know exactly what the trajectory will be. But it has been true for some time that there's been a lot of growth of jobs at the top and jobs at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, not as strong growth in the jobs in the middle of the income spectrum. You ask what kind of jobs. We're talking about retailing jobs, fast food jobs, that sort of thing. Relatively low skilled. But as I said, at the other end of the spectrum, there is strong demand for engineers, strong demand for people with computer science skills. What we need to do is try to strengthen that middle class. And I've always put a huge emphasis on the importance of education for preparing people for a more of a middle class employment.
Yeah, and I really, to add to that, it is really talking about the need to ramp up our investments in education, because if you really take a look at the last 10 years or so, we are cutting higher education. Tuition has doubled. I don't know if you know anybody that has to send their kids to school or is starting to save for their kids. It's a pretty frightening prospect. Where K-12 education has been increased a little bit, inflation way outpaces the amount of money that has been added to the K-12 budget. Take a look at our general fund. That's down by 25%. Revenue sharing has been slashed. So if we're going to make the investments that will have eventually a positive impact on employment, we've got to start doing that right now. If you take a look at the highest occupations that are employing people right now, where there's the greatest amount of workers,
right.
You look at retail salespeople, office clerks, cashiers, registered nurses. Those are like sort of the 4 top occupations in terms of being employed in our state. And registered nurses, they obviously fare the best, but the others are having a very hard time being able to support their families. They're just not making enough money.
So we're looking, what, $10, $11, $12 an hour?
Well, this is back from 2012, but sales clerks are making about $10 an hour, office clerks a little over 13, cashiers $9 an hour. Registered nurses, they do great, $30.69 an hour.
So what I'm hearing is this, the debate we're having over the minimum wage, and should it be $9.40 an hour, should it work its way up to $10.10 an hour, at any rate, that still doesn't get people up to maybe the level where they need to be.
No, absolutely not. And a lot of people who are in low-wage jobs or minimum-wage jobs still need to access public services to make ends meet. They still, many of them can qualify to get food assistance or some cash assistance. So if you are doing the right thing in our state, you're playing by the rules, you're trying to do what everybody wants you to do, you still can't make ends meet.
One of the policies that I think is a really important one is the earned income tax credit. And we in Michigan, to our credit, 7 years ago, joined about 20 other states that had topped up the federal EITC, and we augmented the federal EITC by 20%. And that could make a substantial difference to the folks in low-income working families. Unfortunately, in 2011, one of the things that we did was we scaled it back. There were those who wanted to eliminate it entirely. Gilda was one of the leaders in the fight to keep at least a part of it, and it was cut back from a 20% top-up to a 6% top-up. I think Gilda and I would both love to see it back where it was, because the earned income tax credit is a policy that not only really makes a big difference to the lives of working poor, but it also has been shown to stimulate employment. It's actually a policy, unlike sort of old-style welfare programs, which honestly do have some negative employment effects. The Earned Income Tax Credit leads to a greater level of employment because it's a subsidy to the earnings of these working poor families. And so that's a direction that I would really like to see us go back to.
And, you know, another interesting thing about the EITC is that that has a direct correlation to lifting kids out of poverty, but doing better in school and actual high school completion, which there is a direct connection between that, as well as Charlie says, sort of stimulating the economy, the local economy in particular. So, yeah, the restoration of the Earned Income Tax Credit, it doesn't cost that much, quite honestly, but it has huge, huge effects.
If you've just joined us, that was the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, Gilda Jacobs. And she's joined by Michigan State University economist Charlie Ballard. As we take a look at the kinds of jobs that are available in Michigan, it seems a lot of jobs, but a lot of these jobs really don't give enough of a wage for people to be able to support their families, where they wind up needing state support. And there's certainly, it seems like what I'm hearing is pay it now or pay it later. Either let's look at, you know, stopping the disinvestment in education so people are coming out trained better for these better jobs, or we're going to be paying in terms of state support.
I think you're absolutely right. And the sort of backloaded policy of cutting taxes now and reducing our investment in, both in human capital, both in education and also in transportation infrastructure, that policy, I think it's penny wise and pound foolish. You look at transportation; we've disinvested in roads and bridges, and then it costs more down the road to fix one after it's badly deteriorated. Sort of the same thing with the education system. If you don't invest early, you're going to have children who have fallen behind, and trying to fix the situation when that child is much older is a whole lot more expensive than getting in on the ground floor and really making the early investments that are so important. That's why I'm glad at least one policy that we've made that I think is a move in the right direction is the expansion of slots in early childhood education.
Right, and that will have a far-reaching effect on these kids later on. So that's probably one of the best return on investments that we can make. Is with the expansion of early childhood education.
But that's a start.
It's just a start. I mean, I think we really have to also look at tax policy in general. You know, what we've done is we've taken the same pie and just shifted it around. We're not increasing the pie, if you will, and our some of our important services, we'd like to say, are on starvation diets in Michigan. There's really, as I said before, really been a disinvestment. So we really need to take a look at tax policy. Is it really adequate to provide the services that we need and to get the best return on investment on some of the things that we know really work?
Have we become in Michigan a two-class state in terms of economic stability, Charlie?
Well, Michigan is actually quite common. We are very similar to most states across the country, where what's happened in the last 40 years has been that the economy has grown. In fact, the U.S. economy is more than twice as big as it was in the early 70s. And yet, the median man who works full-time year-round earns less now than in 1973. And that's just one of many statistics that I could give you that show that there's been a growing economy, but it's been growing only for those above the median. And the farther you get above the median, the better it's been. If you're at the 90th percentile, times have been good. If you're at the 99th percentile, times have been fabulous. And this is a nationwide phenomenon, and actually the pattern in Michigan is rather similar to the national average, where the top has pulled away from both the middle and the bottom.
Yeah, and if you also take a look at the statistics, there has been a huge increase, uptick in poverty throughout the state, and in particular, kids living in poverty. When you have half of the kids in our state that are on free or reduced lunch, that tells you that this economy has not been recovering for everybody and that there really are two different classes of people in our state.
When we talk about these low-paying jobs that are going to be growing at such a fast rate in Michigan, the restaurant jobs, the service workers, the health care support, buildings and grounds and maintenance workers, those jobs aren't going to go away. So how do we make them better? Charlie?
Well, we've mentioned things like the earned income tax mm-hmm. credit and the minimum wage, both of which could take that same job and boost its pay. Another thing that I think is very important, Gilda and I have both talked a lot about education. And if you have a better education system, then you'll have more people who are able to compete for the top jobs and fewer people who really have no choice but to compete for the bottom jobs. And if really your skill level is so low that the only thing you can do is to either be a laborer a low-skilled job, then you're really in a very tight spot. You don't have much bargaining power relative to any employer. I would love to see the market wages for those low-skilled jobs increase by changing the relative scarcity of high-skilled workers and low-skilled workers by having more high-skilled workers. And even regardless of what happens to the market, I think we need to keep an eye on our wage-setting institutions, things like the minimum wage and the earned income tax credit, to try to boost those folks at the bottom.
And, you know, there's another thing that sometimes gets lost when we talk about low-wage workers. So many of them get no sick time off, or if they have to go take care of a child that's sick. They are afraid to leave their job even for one day because it may mean that they're going to lose their job. And there is no flexibility built into these jobs. So, you know, I used to be a legislator. We talked about we wanted parents to be more involved in their children's lives, and yet nowhere do we build in the ability or a flexibility with people to be able to take an hour off to go to a parent-teacher conference or to not send their child to school if they're sick. Or if you're sick and you're working in the restaurant business, you still go because you're worried that you're going to lose your job. Those are changes that don't cost a lot of money, but really improve the quality of life and the working conditions for people who don't have that built into their job.
Gilda, would that be legislated, and then wouldn't business say, well, Lansing, you can't tell us what to do, what kind of policy? I mean, I'm sure this is a conversation you've had.
But you would hope that businesses would get that and understand that because, you know, as a business person, you don't want to have a big turnover of your employees. And if you can set up a situation where there is some bit of flexibility where somebody doesn't worry about being fired and then the employer has to worry about training somebody new again, that's something that employers should really want to embrace.
Michigan State University economist Charles Ballard joined us, and the president and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy, Gilda Jacobs. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, we love to hear from you, find out the stories you're focused on, the people you want us to profile, the issues you care about. Let us know. Find us on Facebook. You can search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, you can find us at michiganradio.org. Click on the link that says Stateside. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Omar Saoudeh, Katie Suha, Jeff Orniak, and Chrissy Zamron. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.